Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 13th of January, these are our main stories. The Pentagon says the Houthis have reacted to US and UK airstrikes in Yemen by firing a missile at another ship, reportedly a tanker carrying Russian oil. Joe Biden says action had to be taken.
I don't think there's any civilian casualties. That's another reason why it's a success.
The airstrikes have prompted huge rallies in Yemen's capital and condemnation from Russia, Turkey and Iran. And a UN aid official says the conditions on the ground in Gaza are beyond anyone's worst nightmare. Also in this podcast, Cape Verde becomes the first country in sub-Saharan Africa in 50 years to eradicate malaria. And a bear with what may be post-traumatic stress disorder gets a new home in Scotland.
He's been through a lot. He's been in the middle of a war zone, and we would expect him to be quite nervous. We have to obviously approach with caution and make sure that we're catering to Yampol's needs as an individual.
Houthi fighters have responded to last night's airstrikes by American and British forces by firing another missile at a ship off the coast of Yemen, according to the Pentagon. But that vessel, it seems, was carrying Russian oil, and Russia had condemned the US-led airstrikes as illegitimate. Meanwhile, hundreds of thousands of people gathered in the Yemeni capital, Sana'a, chanting, "Death to America, death to Israel." It was the attacks by Houthis on international shipping which had led to the American and British airstrikes in the first place. In Washington, President Biden said that he considered the Houthis a terrorist group, and he called the military action against them a success.
I don't think there's any civilian casualties. That's another reason why it's a success.
The Department of Defense spokesman, Major General Patrick Ryder, said the military action had very clear aims.
We targeted specific facilities and capabilities intended to degrade and disrupt the Houthis' ability to conduct the kinds of attacks that we've been seeing. And we'll be prepared to take further action should we need to.
Our defense correspondent, Jonathan Beale, has our first report.
This was a US-led and coordinated operation. At night, dozens of jets taking off from one of its aircraft carriers already in the Red Sea. The scene of recent tensions. The impact soon felt right across the large chunk of Yemen the Houthi rebels control. The US said more than 60 strikes on military facilities, specifically radar, drones and missile sites the Houthis have been using in recent months to target merchant shipping in the Red Sea, prompted, they say, by Israel's war in Gaza. The Houthis had already been warned to stop or face the consequences. Britain was the only other country to directly participate in the strikes. Both Britain and the US have said they hope this action will reduce tensions in the region. The danger now is of more tit-for-tat attacks. But that's still more containable than a wider Middle East conflict. The West's hope that the Houthis' main backer, Iran, will still not get directly involved. Downing Street said there were currently no plans to repeat last night's airstrikes. But President Biden says he won't hesitate, if necessary, to do the same again.
Jonathan Beale. Worldwide reaction to the strikes has been divided. Many allies of the US have expressed their support, but other countries reacted with fury. Russia and Iran condemned the action, while Turkey accused Britain and America of turning the Red Sea into a sea of blood. Here's our World Affairs correspondent, Caroline Hawley.
For the past 3 months, tireless international diplomacy has been devoted to trying to contain the crisis that followed the Hamas assault into Israel on October the 7th. This significant spillover has caused deep concern around the Middle East, a region already very much on edge. Many Arab countries have joined Russia and, of course, Iran in criticising the airstrikes. Bahrain alone in the region in supporting them. Oman, a Western ally that's mediated with Iran in the past, said it condemned the bombing, while Israel was continuing what it called its brutal war and siege of Gaza without accountability. President Erdogan of Turkey described the strikes as a disproportionate use of force by America, backed by Britain.
At the moment, they're trying to turn the Red Sea into a sea of blood. And Yemen, with the Houthis and by using all of its force, says it is giving and will give the necessary response in the region to America and Britain.
The countries that have supported the strikes say there was no alternative, with the Houthis holding international shipping and trade to ransom. The Defence Minister of Australia, Richard Marles, said it had personnel in the operational headquarters.
The actions that have been taken today, supported by Australia, are about maintaining freedom of navigation on the high seas. They are about maintaining global trade. That is completely central to Australia's national interest.
American officials say there's no reason for this to escalate any further.
Caroline Hawley. Israel has called on the International Court of Justice to reject the case brought by South Africa, which alleges that it is committing genocide in Gaza. On the second and final day of hearings at the UN's highest court, Israel's lawyers said that South Africa had presented a sweeping counterfactual description of the conflict. This was the nub of the Israeli argument, as spelt out by the country's Deputy Attorney General, Gilad Noam.
Yes, there is a heart-wrenching armed conflict. But the attempt to classify it as genocide and trigger provisional measures is not just unfounded in law. It has far-reaching and negative implications that extend well beyond the case before you. Ultimately, entertaining the applicant's request will not strengthen the commitment to prevent and punish genocide, but weaken it. It will turn an instrument adopted by the international community to prevent horrors of the kind that shocked the conscience of humanity during the Holocaust into a weapon in the hands of terrorist groups who have no regard for humanity or for the law.
Outside the court, South Africa's Justice Minister Ronald Lamola was still sounding bullish.
We stand by the facts, the law, and all the evidence we have submitted yesterday. And we believe and stand very confident that those facts, the law, still are in violation of the Genocide Convention.
So what happens next and when can we expect a verdict? Anna Holligan has been following proceedings from the ICJ in The Hague and gave me an update.
These hearings have focused on interim measures. South Africa has asked for an urgent injunction to prevent any further harm. So South Africa had 3 hours, Israel had 3 hours. Now the judges will probably issue a decision within a matter of weeks. And that decision, it will not affect the more fundamental case. A decision on South Africa's claim that Israel is committing genocide will probably take many more years. This is a legal battlefields. I haven't ever seen a case at the ICJ which has generated so much media and public attention. So often these cases happen retrospectively, sometimes decades after the conflicts themselves. This one isn't. There is a sense that what happens here in The Hague could have a real impact on the ground.
Anna, when you were speaking to this programme yesterday, you were making the point that the ICJ is now being used by outside actors to make a case. I think you mentioned Myanmar, China and Ukraine. Viewed from the perspective of the ICJ, is that a good thing or is that a dangerous thing?
I think when I was in the Peace Palace earlier and just seeing the two sides side by side and having these legal arguments, if this can be used as a way to minimise harm on the actual battlefield, then I think many people would say that's a good thing. There is a danger that courts can be politicised and they have to avoid that by focusing purely on the law and the evidence presented. Legal experts, lawyers, the public, they'll be going through the judgment with a fine-tooth comb to find any evidence of bias, and the judges will be very aware of that and they will be doing everything possible to avoid any feeling that they are not basing any judgment on anything other than the law.
Anna Holligan in The Hague. Our diplomatic correspondent Paul Adams was also watching today's testimony by Israel and has this analysis.
Israel could have chosen to ignore the proceedings at The Hague. Instead, it mounted a robust, vigorous defence, summed up perhaps by the words of Professor Malcolm Shaw, the British barrister in charge of presenting Israel's case.
There is no genocidal intent here. This is no genocide.
The question of intent is key. Israeli leaders, including the President and Prime Minister, have made frequent incendiary comments over the past 3 months, leading some to conclude that Israel is hell-bent on destroying not just Hamas, but the Palestinian people as a whole. But the most apparently genocidal remarks have not been made by those actually running Israel's military campaign. They might reflect an ugly prevailing climate in Israel, but they don't actually represent policy. And when it comes to the way Israel has conducted its military operations, its lawyers kept asking a question. Why would an army intent on committing genocide go to such lengths to tell Palestinians to get out of harm's way? For the people of Gaza, that sounds hollow. Many did follow Israel's instructions to move away from danger, only to find themselves being bombed anyway. Israel seems confident that the charge of genocide will not be upheld. It'll be years before we find out. But it's worth remembering one thing. This case is not about war crimes or even ethnic cleansing. It's about the ultimate crime of a state trying to destroy an entire people. And that, Israel says, is not what it's doing in Gaza.
Paul Adams. A UN official who has just returned from Gaza described it as beyond anyone's worst nightmare. Dominic Allen said the situation is only getting worse and the world needs to help to get aid in at scale now. The BBC's Neda Torfik has more.
After a week in Gaza, Mr. Allen said it was incomparable to anything he or other humanitarians had ever seen before. He described seeing fear, despair, and desperation everywhere, and no basics for sustaining life. He said 5,500 pregnant women were due to have a child this month. If the bombs don't kill them, if disease, hunger, and dehydration don't catch up with them, he said simply giving birth would. He visited partially functioning hospitals. At one, the Emirati Hospital, women in their final stages of labor were having to rotate in and out because there wasn't enough room. After birth, they're given a matter of hours to be discharged. There are 180 babies being born every day in Gaza, and doctors have reported seeing higher rates of malnutrition and below average weights.
Neda Torfik. Meanwhile, Israel says it has reached an agreement with Qatar that will allow the delivery of medication to hostages being held by Hamas in Gaza. The supplies are expected to be sent over the coming days. Our Middle East correspondent, Wira Davis, gave me an update from Jerusalem.
The families of the 130 or so hostages that are being kept in Gaza by Hamas and other armed Palestinian groups have been putting an awful lot of pressure on the Israeli government to do more to secure their release and, at worst, to make sure that medical aid gets through to them, because there's been an absence of that for the last 100 days. And, of course, after the recent assassinations in Lebanon of a leading Hamas figure and a leading Hezbollah figure, it's presumed by Israel, negotiations between the Israelis and the Qataris over the fate of the hostages appear to have been broken down. But in the last couple of days, that link, that path was restarted again. The head of the Mossad was believed to have gone to Qatar, and the Qataris, of course, speak to Hamas. And now a deal has been put together which will ensure that the medical aid so badly needed by many of the hostages, including diabetes medication, blood pressure medication, should get through to those hostages who have been held incommunicado somewhere in Gaza, presumably many of them underground. The quid pro quo is that much of the medication that's needed by the population of Gaza itself, many of whom have been displaced from their homes, that will also increase. Of course, humanitarian aid is badly needed in Gaza. Medical aid in particular is badly needed. So the Israelis will allow more medical aid to get to the Palestinians, and Hamas will allow specific medical aid required by some of the hostages. It's not quite as much of the hostage families want, but it is a sign of progress.
Wira Davis. Cape Verde has become the first country in sub-Saharan Africa in 50 years to eradicate malaria, and just the fourth on the continent ever. The status was confirmed by the World Health Organization after 3 years without a single case being reported. Our Africa health correspondent Dorcas Wangira sent this report.
Cape Verde may be a small island nation, but its achievement is huge. Countries that have achieved at least 3 consecutive years of 0 local cases are eligible to apply for a WHO certification of malaria-free status. Dr. Dorothy Achu, team lead at WHO Regional Office for Africa, told the BBC that it's taken a lot of effort.
We are really pleased that there are some concrete results coming out from the efforts that not working just like doctors, medical doctors, but also vector control teams, educational communication experts in the region have been doing to ensure that malaria is kicked off out of Africa.
A survivor of the deadly disease in the island remembers what it was like.
I suffered from malaria and I was hospitalized for 15 years at the Praia Hospital. If Cape Verde is officially free of malaria, I can only congratulate the government and all the medical team who worked for this result.
The country's strengthened health system ensures increased access to proper diagnosis of all cases and treatment. Free care and diagnostic services for international travelers and migrants is a priority. Dr. Filomena Gonçalves is Cape Verde's health minister.
It is a testimony to what can be achieved through collective commitment to improving public health. Without a doubt, the eradication of malaria is a strong attraction for tourism. This achievement not only improves public health, but also reinforces Cape Verde's image as a safe and healthy destination.
Dorcas Wangira. Still to come in the Global News podcast.
Oh, I'm very, very excited. We have known about the Upano Valley findings, but we have never seen them displayed in the way that they're being shown now by airborne technology.
We hear more about the discovery of a huge ancient city in the Amazon. The Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, is heavily reliant on the West for financial and military support in its ongoing war with Russia. But Republicans in the US Congress are blocking President Biden from sending an estimated $60 billion in emergency aid to Ukraine. Meanwhile, Hungary's president, Viktor Orban, is vetoing funding from the European Union. However, on Friday, there was some good news for Ukraine as the British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak signed a new security pact with President Zelensky in the capital Kyiv. Mr. Sunak promised his country's unwavering support for Ukraine.
We will provide the modern equipment across land, sea and sky, sanction Russia's economy and work closely with allies to do so. You will not have to ask. You will not have to argue for what you need. The UK will be there from the first moment to the last.
Mr. Zelensky called the security agreement, which covers intelligence sharing, cybersecurity and arms manufacturing, a watershed moment in European history. Our correspondent in Kyiv, Abdujalil Abdurasilov, told me about the significance of the agreement.
Well, essentially, this visit and the announcement about the security deal, they are all aimed at one thing: to send a message to the Ukrainian government, to the people of Ukraine, and also to Moscow as well, that Ukraine is not alone and will not be alone, as Prime Minister Rishi Sunak said during his press conference. Mr. Sunak announced a new military aid package worth $3.2 billion. And that package will include long-range missiles, air defense and artillery ammunition, anti-tank weapons, and also drones. He says that about £200 million will be spent to deliver drones to Ukraine. And of course, this announcement comes at a critical time when other allies, the US and the EU, are still struggling to release their own military and financial packages. And this deal is sending a key message that Ukraine will still receive its aid and support from its partners. And also the new security deal that was signed today by the UK and Ukraine, it includes the provision to continue military support in a long-term basis. However, These are not security guarantees, as some people assume. These are provisions to continue military support in the sense that providing weapons, training personnel, and also sharing intelligence. But it doesn't include the guarantees in the sense that the UK and other countries that will sign similar deals will not send their troops to Ukraine and fight on behalf of Ukraine.
Abdujalil Abdurasulov. The head of the UN Human Rights Agency has criticised a crackdown on drugs in Sri Lanka, which has resulted in the arrest of nearly 30,000 people in just under a month. With more details, here's Rachel Wright.
Every day for the past month, Sri Lankan television has been flooded with dramatic pictures of drug seizures, mass arrests and sniffer dogs. On December the 17th, the acting chief of police and the Minister of Public Security announced Operation Yuktia, a crackdown on illegal drugs, because they claimed Sri Lanka had become a drug trafficking transit point. They said they aimed to rid the country of illegal drugs by June this year. But more than 30 international human rights organisations, including Amnesty International, have expressed deep concern over the actions of the police. And today, the head of the UN Human Rights Agency, Volker Türk, echoed those sentiments and called on the government to review the operation. In a statement, Mr. Türk said security forces have reportedly subjected people to a number of violations, including unauthorized searches, arbitrary arrests and detention, ill treatment, torture and strip searches in public. He also said that lawyers acting for those who have been detained are being intimidated by police officers. Local human rights activists said the arrests were not based on evidence, but targeted drug users and small-time dealers in poor areas. But the acting head of police, Deshabandhu Tenakun, said the operation is effective.
Most of you are under the impression that the police are arresting the small-scale dealers instead of the large-scale drug traffickers. That is true. When we arrest the small-scale dealers, we will get a hold of those behind the mega dealings. If you take a look at the statistics during the last week and the week before, the crime rate in this country has dropped significantly. When we eliminate drug trafficking in the next 6 months, the crime rate of this country will go down by 50%.
With almost 1,000 people a day being arrested in this crackdown, the Sri Lankan Human Rights Commission says the operation will only exacerbate the problem of prison overcrowding.
Rachel Wright with that report. Taiwan holds its elections on Saturday amid escalating tension with China. Beijing sees the self-governed island as a breakaway province that will eventually be part of the country and has not ruled out the use of force to achieve this. The contest is between the two major parties that have dominated Taiwanese politics for decades, the Democratic Progressive Party, currently in power, and the opposition party, Kuomintang. Home to just 70,000 residents, Kinmen is nestled right beside mainland China. It has its own history and sense of identity, and not everyone supports the current president's rocky relationship with Beijing, as the BBC's Asia-Pacific editor Celia Hatton has been finding out.
We've just arrived in the airport on Kinmen Island, the only airport, I should say, on this tiny island. It's geographically close to mainland China. In fact, it's so close you can see mainland China from Kinmen. A short drive away from the airport, we go to a place that highlights the close connections between Kinmen and mainland China. We've come to the ferry terminal. It only takes half an hour to take the ferry from here to mainland China. Mr. Tsai from the terminal's ticket office says the ferry is much less busy now than before the pandemic.
At the moment, the ferry provides 8 round trips per day and carries about 60 to 70% of the total passenger capacity. Because of the election, more people are coming into Kinmen in recent days than going out because they need to come back to vote. The trip is about 9 nautical miles and passengers are mainly Taiwanese businessmen, people who visit relatives, and small traders. We're a special service. No matter how tense the cross-strait relationship is, this route will always be open. That's our basic consensus with the mainland.
The dock workers are getting ready for the ferry to arrive. Almost everyone coming off the ferry is carrying huge cardboard boxes and shopping bags.
I went to the mainland to do shopping about every half a month or once a month.
I commute quite frequently for my business, selling small accessories, wholesale.
There's a petition here to build a bridge between Kinmen and mainland China. One of the passengers coming off the ferry happened to be a local woman who's part of a group promoting peace between Beijing and Taiwan. We asked her what she thought of the bridge idea.
It's been under discussion for years, but has faced many obstacles. Personally, I hope the bridge could be built at the end. I think it's good for the cross-strait transportation and also be good for the friendly exchanges between people on both sides.
There's also an idea for Kinmen to become kind of a demilitarized zone between Taiwan and China. But with tensions so high, few think that's a possibility now. The Everett Shopping Mall was built for Chinese tourists. It's got a Starbucks, a McDonald's, and lots of luxury stores. There are a few people walking around in here, but they're people from Kinmen Island, because the tourist trade from China has been stopped. And that's really the case in point. People who live on Taiwan's main island can really get by existing in a bubble if they want to. They can avoid thinking about the possible threat posed by China. But that's just not possible in Kinmen, because this place is interconnected with the mainland. There's a real awareness here that peace with China should be preserved. We've come to our last stop on Kinmen, at the workshop of Master Wu, a highly skilled blacksmith. He makes knives from old pieces of artillery, shells that were fired on Kinmen from neighboring China right up until 1979.
It represents war and peace, like turning hostility into friendship or beating swords into plowshares. It's a symbol of peace.
There's a saying on the island, war is ruthless, peace is priceless. We ask Master Wu about it.
Kinmen has been through war. For most of our Kinmenese, to maintain peace is a universal goal. It's the most important thing. People from both sides of the strait are all Chinese. If we can stay friendly and peaceful with the mainland, it'll be best for Kinmen. And the safest, there's no need for confrontation.
Our Asia-Pacific editor, Celia Hatton, reporting from Kinmen Island. We told you briefly in our earlier edition of this podcast about the discovery of a huge city in the heart of the Amazon rainforest. For thousands of years, it was hidden under a vast canopy of green in the Upano area of eastern Ecuador. The researchers found that the houses and plazas were connected by an astounding network of roads and canals. Experts say it's hugely significant and suggest some ancient civilizations in the Amazon rainforest were more sophisticated. The city lay in the shadow of a volcano which could have ultimately led to its destruction. Manuel Arroyo Calin from the Institute of Archaeology at University College London is an expert on the region of South America where the discovery was made. He spoke to Anita Anand.
Oh, I'm very, very excited. We have known about the Upano Valley findings for some time, but we have never seen them displayed in the way that they're being shown now by the application of new airborne technology. And the scale at which they're shown today and the arguments that have been put together in the recent paper that has been published in Science begins to tie a number of aspects that allow us to look at contemporaneity, connectivity, landscape modification, and intensification. It's fascinating.
Okay, it's hard, isn't it? When you've got a rainforest, you've got such thick growth over the top. How have they seen these roads and these pathways?
Yes, so it's the application of technology known as LIDAR. That's laser detection and ranging. It works by laser pulses from an airborne vehicle. The laser pulses are pulsed at millimetric distances, and they reach, if you fly on top of a forest, they reach either the leaves or the floor. And so then through data processing, we clean off those pulses that never reach the floor, and we're left with a contour-shaped image of the ground under the rainforest canopy. So that is millimetric in precision and can allow you to see ditches, mounds.
What is so exciting about this is we're talking about permanent structures, permanent civilizations. generations, if you like, in a place where it has always been assumed that people have been somewhat nomadic, moving with the seasons. How does it sort of match the time of this ancient civilization with what else was going on around the world?
If you compare to what is happening in the Amazon basin, 2,000, 2,500 years BP, so that's about 500 BC, is a significant time because at that time we are only beginning to see the inklings of other landscape modifications of a similar size or similar scale in other parts, but not necessarily in Amazonia itself. There are some earlier developments in other parts of South America, notably in the Peruvian semi-arid coast and then also in Ecuador. And indeed, if you compare it to some of the findings in Europe and Asia and Africa, timings are different. It's a big world.
Yeah, it is a big world. I mean, just very briefly, is it too soon to suppose what these people might have been like, looked like, lived like?
In short, yes. I mean, archaeologists working in the Americas start with the impact of European colonization as a process. We know the people that lived there at the time that Europeans arrived, and we know the descendants of those people. There's records. But as soon as you push back 1,500 years from that timeline, the people that are there are most likely the forebearers of some of the indigenous peoples in the Amazon today, but we don't know precisely whom, so we will refer to them as different cultural groups as described by archaeology. Yet at this site, some of the groups that occupy the location around 900 AD are connected to some of the indigenous groups of Ecuador today, and they might in themselves claim that their great-great-grandparents built these sites.
Manuel Arroyo-Colin from the Institute of Archaeology at UCL, speaking to Anita Anand. A bear rescued from a war zone by Ukrainian soldiers has been rehomed at a zoo near Edinburgh in Scotland. He was found injured and traumatised in an abandoned zoo in Donetsk in the east of the country after months of Russian occupation. Our Scotland correspondent Jamie McIver reports.
Yampo, the Asiatic black bear, is named after the town in eastern Ukraine where he was discovered. The area had been occupied by Russian forces, but when the town was retaken by Ukraine, Yampo was one of the few animals found alive in the zoo. He was suffering from concussion and moved to an animal sanctuary in Belgium, where he was looked after for several months. Now the 30-stone bear has a home at Five Sisters Zoo near West Calder in West Lothian. This morning he was introduced to his enclosure after a long overnight journey from Dover. Adam Welsh is from the zoo.
He's been through a lot. He's been in the middle of a war zone, and we would expect him to be quite nervous, potentially show some signs similar to those from people that are suffering from PTSD. We're still going to approach with caution. We need to make sure that he has some time to settle in here, and we have to obviously approach with caution and make sure that we're catering to Yampo's needs as an individual.
The zoo is trying to raise £200,000 to cover the cost of a new permanent enclosure. It has worked with a number of rescued bears before, but none of them have drawn quite so much attention as Yampo.
Jamie McIver. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast at the same time tomorrow. This edition was mixed by Davith Evans, and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.
Sasha hated sand, the way it stuck to things for weeks. So when Maddie shared a surf trip on Expedia Trip Planner, he hesitated. Then he added a hotel with a cliffside pool to the plan, and they both spent the week in the water. You were made to follow your whims. We were made to help find a place on the beach with a pool and a waterfall and a soaking tub and, of course, a great shower. Expedia. Made to travel.
Hey, you. Yeah, talking to you. Welcome to Audible, where there's endless ways to ignite your imagination, like chase your thrills, slay your demons, even journey into the great unknown. And if you're lucky, discover someone, something new to love. Hear the latest audiobooks, podcasts, and originals at audible.ca.